Anyhow, it's a pleasure to be here today, and on behalf of my colleagues, Lindsay Turner, Dan Tabor, and Freight Chalupka, pleasure to be here. And one thing that we're going to do, I'm going to talk about today, and I have no financial relationships to disclose, by the way. I'm going to focus in on elementary school environment, and it's a little bit different than a lot of the other competitive food presentations that at least I've heard thus far at this meeting. And the reason why I'm focusing on the elementary school environment is one reason in particular, and that's because this is the first generation of kids who are going to consistently be exposed to policy changes starting in first grade forward. You know, we know that the one list policy requirement took effect with the beginning of 2006-07 school year. And from some data that I'm going to present today and that I've presented elsewhere and that Michael cited to, we know that most school districts nationwide have one list policies in place. They vary greatly in terms of their strength and their comprehensiveness. But we also know that the policies tend to be much stronger at the elementary level than they are at the secondary school levels, middle and high school in particular. And so the elementary school kids are the first ones to have an opportunity to go through their entire elementary school cohort, at least the ones who are starting school in 2006-07, will be the first ones to go through elementary school through all 5 years, maybe 6 years, depending on what their school environment looks like, where they may be potentially exposed to really strong restrictions on foods and beverages. And so for that cohort, it might make it a little bit easier to shift policy gradually and incrementally as you move into the middle and high school eras, because those kids will have been used to being in a different environment than certainly what I grew up with several decades ago. So without further ado, I'm going to just bug a little bit on Michael's very helpful background that he provided. And you would think that we actually had planned these presentations, which we did not, because he actually had some really different introductory slides than I have here. So I think it will all fit really nicely together. So a little bit of background on the prevalence of competitive food and beverage consumption. Tell you a little bit about public policies governing this area. And then tell you a little bit about our study where we linked state laws, district policies with elementary school practices nationwide. So one of the things we highlighted in the IOM report that Michael alluded to, the Accelerating Progress in Obesity Prevention, is that children's consumption of solid fats and added sugars certainly exceeds recommended dietary guidelines. Between 2005 and 8, 16% of all children's dietary intake or daily caloric intake was from added sugars, with, interestingly enough, about 59% of that being from foods and 41% being from beverages. Regular sodas, fruit drinks, and whole milk were three of the top six products adding empty calories to children's diets. That was from Jill Reedy and colleagues in 2010. And the top food source for children ages 2 to 18 are grain-based desserts that include those high-fat, high-sugary desserts such as cookies, cakes, donuts, so on and so forth. We know from data that we've produced out of the Bridging the Gap program at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and Lindsay Turner here, my colleague, is the lead on these studies. We know that about half of all elementary school students nationwide have access to competitive foods in schools. It's much to the chagrin of what a lot of people say, where they say that we've basically gotten rid of competitive foods in elementary schools. There still are a lot that exist, particularly in the a la carte settings and in the snack bars or school stores. About 55% have access to competitive beverages, again, much too different than what some other data sources have reported recently. And in school year 2009-10, we saw that more than 44% of all elementary school students had access to high-fat and sugary foods. 12% could still purchase SSBs, and 25% could purchase high-fat milks in competitive food and beverage venues. So these will include vending machine school stores a la carte, and a la carte settings. We know at the federal level currently the only federal law governing competitive foods and beverages are the Foods of Minimal Nutritional Value restriction, which basically prohibits the sale of certain candies and carbonated beverages in competition with the meal program at lunchtime. Other than that, there are no federal laws governing the sale of competitive foods and beverages or the offering of competitive foods and beverages in schools. The USDA, as Michael alluded to, has forthcoming regulations. We don't know when they will be issued, but we know that they will be after the election. And we also know, though, that the congressional mandate for the USDA regulations is not written to be preemptive. So We likely will have a multi-jurisdictional approach to policy in this area going forward, where we'll have a federal standard that will likely set the baseline or a floor, and we'll also continue to have state laws and district policies in this area. So it's really important to understand not just what may happen at the federal level, but to continue to understand and monitor what states and districts are doing in this area. A number of states have developed laws restricting competitive food and beverage environments, many of which, although they were not required to do so, many of which did so at about the same time as the district policy started emerging. So the Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act of 2004 mandated that all school districts in the U.S. that participate in the federal school meal programs adopt and implement a wellness policy by the first day of school year 2006-07, which included, among other things, guidelines for foods and beverages sold outside of the meal program. We saw about the same time a number of states to really start to develop their laws in this area. Part of my speculation is that law served as a triggering event for states, and the states also wanted to develop some sort of model guidance for what districts should do, or they wanted to try and ensure some type of uniformity across districts within the state. I just mentioned the district requirement under Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act, and then again in 2010, Congress reauthorized the wellness policy provision as part of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010 and continued the requirement that the district policies include guidelines for foods and beverages sold or served outside of the meal programs. The other thing that USDA or Congress required in the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act is that for the first time, USDA, besides developing competitive food regulations, will also be required to develop regulations governing the wellness policies. So we actually might just start to see a little more uniformity with regard to the wellness policies, and they're also requiring USDA to develop some technical assistance and other materials to help districts and states in implementing both the competitive food standards and the wellness policy requirement. Most of the research to date in this area has really focused at the secondary school level. Michael illustrated some of it today. A lot of it shows a positive relationship. It's not necessarily impactful analyses. It's correlational in many cases, and in many cases, it's cross-sectional types of analyses, looking at the relationship between state laws and the availability, consumption, and student intake related to competitive food and beverages. So far, from what we can tell from the literature, there's no study that's actually looked at the combination of having strong state laws, strong district policies, or both strong state law and district policy on competitive food and beverage availability nationwide at the elementary level, and so that was the purpose of this study. I should note that we don't have student-level data at the elementary school level in our Bridging the Gap study, unfortunately, so the farthest I can go with this analysis is to school availability. I should also note that our elementary school data is a nationally representative cross-sectional study each year, and so we don't have a panel designed to do a longitudinal analysis. Hello. Okay, so the data for this study came from the Bridging the Gap Research Program. We're at the University of Illinois Chicago, and we're sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We do primary legal research and analysis, so we get on the books state laws and regulations for every single state in the U.S., and we include the District of Columbia there. We have a nationally representative sample of school districts nationwide where we actually get their on-the-books wellness policy that's been adopted by the school board, any regulations that have been adopted by the district superintendent, as well as any policies or regulations that are embedded by reference in their wellness policy or district regulations. So it's a very comprehensive capture of district policies. I should say the same thing happens with the state laws. We get the state statutory laws or legislative laws, state regulatory laws, and any other laws and policies embedded by reference at the state level. Our survey is based on this nationally representative sample of elementary schools located in the districts where we get the wellness policies from. And these are annual nationally representative samples. The data for this analysis were from three school years, 2008 to 9 through 10 to 11. I think I just mentioned this. The only thing I should note here is that the state laws that we looked at were effective as of the beginning of September of each year. We use that as our proxy for the beginning of each school year. And we also verified all of our state law data against existing secondary sources available from NASB, CSPI, F as in Fat, CDC, you pretty much name it, we've sourced it against them. The district wellness policies, I've already described what we include there. We've got about 600 districts on average per year in our sample. We do primary collection of all these policies. So this is not a survey-based thing at all for determining policy. This is what policies are actually on the books at the state level and at the district level. I've seen a lot of differences in policies on the books versus policies in practice, so we don't rely on surveys for getting the policy data. This is primary policy research and analysis here. We've had a 96% to 98% collection rate per year on the wellness policy side of things. So we have quite a high response rate in terms of the policies we've collected. The elementary school data is from an annual mailback survey of principals and food service directors that we conduct between February and June of each school year. So the policies are laws and policies in place as of September of each year, and the surveys are school practices in the spring of each school year. So we have the policies and laws that are on the books prior to the surveys actually being conducted. We provide a $100 incentive for completion. Over the three-year pool cross-section, we had about a little over 1,900 respondents, representing 1,582 unique elementary schools located in 1,023 unique districts located in 47 states. I can tell you that all those states were part of the contiguous U.S. We adopted a coding scheme that was originally developed by my friend and colleague Marlene Schwartz at the Yale Red Center and some of her colleagues who are Healthy Eating Research grantees. Many of you have probably already seen it. We double-coded all the state laws and district policies on each of eight specific items. For this analysis, I focused on, for those of you familiar with the coding scheme, we focused on the strongest of the strong. So we looked specifically at bans on sugar-sweetened beverages, bans on sodas, bans on 2% in whole milk, limits on sugars and foods, specific limits on fats, specific limits on fats and a la carte lines. You'll see why in a minute I separate the two, and limits on sodium in foods and candy bans. For policy predictors, because we wanted to look at whether or not one type of policy is driving what's happening in the elementary school environment, we looked at state laws only, district policies only, and the combination of the two. So is it district policy that's driving the story, is it state law that's driving the story, or is it you're in a school that has both a strong state law and a strong district policy? Went the wrong way, sorry. The elementary school practices that we modeled or correlate with the policies we looked at. So we looked at availability of regular soda, other SSBs, so that would include sports drinks, sweetened teas, fruit drinks, things like that. High-fat milk, so 2% in whole milk. Candy, sweets, those would be things with sugar in the food product. Salty snacks, cookies, and regular fat ice cream. And then this is why I looked at fat in a la carte settings, because we also had a variable for French fries being sold in a la carte lines. We control for a number of characteristics at the school level and geographically, most of which we got from the National Center for Education Statistics Common Core of Data for all the schools in our sample. We also control for region, as well as locale, school size, state level of obesity prevalence, race, majority race and ethnicity of the students, and free and reduced price lunch eligibility participation rates. We use multivariate logistic regression models. Again, all of our outcome variables are dichotomous variables, so we use multivariate logistic regression. We clustered on state and district in all of our models to account for the lack of interdependence among schools located within each district and state. We weighted all of our results to represent public elementary schools nationwide, controlling for all the contextual factors. I do a lot of work presenting to policymakers, and so I tend to try and, like Michael, simplify what sometimes can be complicated data. So for this analysis, I've ran some predictive margins here to compute the adjusted prevalence of the availability of competitive foods and beverages after controlling for all of our control variables within each policy category. So what I'm presenting to you here today are going to be the adjusted prevalence models. So you can see after we've controlled for everything in our logistic regression models, what is the prevalence of these different food and beverage items look like in schools nationwide. And all these models will run in STATA version 12. So just some descriptive data real quick. These are just what the policy data look like. Food policy limits by jurisdiction. So this is the food level, and you can see the blue bar is no policy. The purple is district-only policy. The sort of gray is state-only, and then the far right, the white, is combination of being in a district and a state with a law and policy in this area. You can see that across the board, when they have a law or policy in place, that having a combination of state and district policy is more common than only a district or only a state having a law or policy on the books. This is consistent what we found in another paper that Dan Tabor and I did, where we looked at the correlation between state laws and district policies. We found there that district policies tend to be stronger in states with strong laws, so this is pretty consistent with what we saw there. Interestingly enough, policy prevalence is greatest with regard to fat limits and sugar limits. There's very little in the way of policies governing sodium whatsoever, and it's definitely a missed opportunity for some areas. Beverages. We're talking about elementary school level data here, and so it's interesting, you know, there's very few state laws and district policies that specifically, and these are percent of schools, I should have noted, these are percent of schools located in each jurisdiction with a different policy. Very few state laws and district policies specifically ban all SSBs, more likely to ban sodas altogether, and very few are banning high-fat milks. But even with these small numbers, we see some interesting differences when we get to the regression results. This is the availability of these foods and beverages in the elementary schools themselves. You can see that sweets and salty snacks are the most prevalent food items. And on the beverage side, high-fat milks and non-soda SSBs are more prevalent than just having regular soda. When we get to the adjusted models, so these are the three-year adjusted associations between elementary school competitive food availability and having state and or district policies. The asterisks represent significant differences from having no policy at all. And so you can see here that being in a state and a district with a strong ban on sugar limits or sugar limits on foods, they're less likely to have sweets in schools as compared to being in a school that's located in a state and a district with no policy. We see similar relationships in terms of fat, regular fat baked goods and regular fat ice cream. We don't see any relationships, statistically at least, with French fries or salty snacks. The salty snacks is not surprising given there's barely any policies whatsoever governing sodium. On the beverage side, we do see, interestingly enough, that being in a district that prohibits SSBs is associated with a school being less likely to have any SSBs as compared to not having a policy whatsoever. And on the high-fat milk side, either a district policy or a state law is less likely than being in a school located in a state and a district with no policy in this area. So that, again, remember the prevalence was so low, we didn't expect to see anything there. So to sum up, this is one of the first studies to examine the relationship between district policies and state laws and elementary school competitive food and beverage availability. We do know from our data that competitive food and beverages are still widely available in elementary schools nationwide. We do know also that state laws and district policies are associated with reduced availability of certain foods and beverages, but not all of them. There's definitely opportunities that still exist to improve the elementary school food environment in this country, so we can't just forget about elementary schools, even though we obviously are focusing a lot on the secondary school levels. Beverage bans and sodium limits are particularly lacking in the state laws and district policies. It's important to note, particularly with as USDA works on these nationwide standards, that high-fat milks are still widely available in nearly 1 in 3 public elementary schools nationwide. We still obviously have a patchwork approach to policymaking here, where we see both state laws and district policies, but it's not just one or the other driving it. It's really the combination of the two that seems to be important. As I mentioned earlier, forthcoming federal nationwide standards will most likely set a floor in this area. You know, there are clearly some opportunities here. We definitely need some longitudinal data, which we don't have, and I think it would really help us better understand longitudinally what's happening with elementary school kids. We also are definitely lacking in terms of student-level outcomes, which would be a great add-on if we can find the funding to do that going forward. So I'm going to stop right now and pass it on, I believe, to Kendall. So thank you.